How about that? Much more audible. Okay, good. A couple of announcements before we begin tonight. There will be issues of the Sonora Review for sale outside after the reading, both the current issue and some previous issues. And I also want to announce an event that may be of interest to some of you, which is taking place in the community this weekend, and that's the Chex Press Residency, a weekend residency of writers reading and talking that will feature Karen Kelly and Gil Ott on Friday night, and Sheila Murphy and Leslie Scalapino on Saturday night. Those readings will take place at the Community Design Resource Center downtown on Congress Street. It's a particular pleasure to introduce to you tonight one of our own. Robert Houston is a native of Alabama. In 1973, he received his PhD from the University of Iowa. Since that time, he's been on the faculty here at the University of Arizona. He was a Fulbright Fellow in Peru in 1978 and has also lived and taught in Mexico, has made his creative presence felt around the country at numerous writers' conferences, notably the Breadloaf Writers' Conference in Middlebury, Vermont. He's published 10 novels, including Bisbee 17, The Nation Thief, and most recently, The Fourth Codex. He crossed over that feared and coveted territory into the movie industry when his novel Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday was adapted as the feature film, A Killing Affair. He's currently working on two novels, one titled The Book of the South, which is forthcoming from Pantheon Books, from which he will be reading tonight. So please welcome Robert Houston.
Thank you. You guys are a scary audience, you know, because I can't leave town after the reading, and that makes it doubly scary. I should say that for those of you who are concerned, as I am, with the NEA's policies, that I'm not receiving a penny of NEA money this evening. I'm not receiving a penny, period, but it's at least comfortable. I'm going to read from a novel that I've been working on and at for several years. Continuing my interest in the Third World, it's set in Alabama, which is not, as Saturday Night Live said recently, Darwin's waiting room, after all. On a serious note, I'd like to dedicate this reading this evening to the memory of Cecil Robinson, who died yesterday, who was twice chairman of the English department, one of the kindest human beings I've ever known, a man who is in many ways responsible for my being here this evening, a scholar and a gentleman in the best sense of both those terms. Okay. This is tentatively titled The Book of the South. I might even do it without class. Nah. Don't want to be that macho. It's warm in here. I'll read less than the allotted time this evening. If I don't trip and break my neck first. Less than the allotted time, I hope, and get you out of here in time. Pate knew, by God, what a dollar looked like. First, it looked like a fallow cornfield and 1,000 Chinese coolies putting in a rail bed in the Alabama heat. It looked like woods, enough woods to lose 6 armies in, and surveyor stakes with the little red pennants marching off to get lost in those woods, too. Then it looked like a few dozen clapboard buildings in the cornfield and a couple of board and batten railroad section shacks they called a land company office. It was iron ore and coal they were beating their drums about, but it was land that was making the dollars fly. They were going to build them a city all at once, and a godforsaken wilderness. Pate listened to their curly-cued southern fol-de-rol about redeeming the homeland with their city and their iron furnaces, and he thought, if you people know how to ride the Negroes and the moss-backed farmers up in those hills like you rode them during the war, you'll redeem your pocketbooks, all right. You'll make enough iron in your city to turn every one of you into damned reconstructed millionaires. And either way you bring it in, inventing you a city or making iron, I'll be pleased to pick me a piece of it. He'd ridden a rattling stage south from Chattanooga 2 weeks ago to the railhead, then caught a train into here since the tracks still stopped in the middle of nowhere. When he got off the train, he put up in the only place in town, a wooden thing they called a hotel, where he had to share a room in shifts with 12 other men. Some of them had their pockets full of money, but no stomach. An Irishman lawyer who shared his room got so disgusted after just 2 days, he decided to go back to Ireland and start a revolution. Eat swill, toady to the gentry, and dort on bugs, the Irishman told him. There's your fortune. I'll take me chances with the English. The Lord High Muckledy-Muck of the place was a white-haired tree trunk of a man called Colonel James Powell, and he had energy. That was the trick, energy. Pate first saw him mounted like he was posing for a statue on a rearing calico pony, waving a gold-hilted sword and wearing a flapping red sash, the first Monday of May, 1873, the day Powell made his city real. He had 100-foot-wide streets in the cornfields with no houses on them. He had a mountain of iron ore on one side of him and a sea of coal on the other, with no decent furnace to make it all into iron with, nor a finished railroad to ship it on. But by damn, he had energy, and he wanted his city to be official and a county seat, so he arranged it. He made them vote on it. Vote, my friends, he bellowed at the Negroes as they piled off the excursion trains he had sent out into the wilderness to round them up. Vote for God and your native land. By which Pate knew pissing well he meant the Episcopalian Church in Alabama, but that was all right, too. The Negroes did not seem impressed. Who's that, Captain? One of the Negroes asked Pate as the line of them passed him on the way to the voting table and the free barbecue and corn whiskey. Pate waited until Powell rode close by and stopped bellowing a minute, and he said loud enough so that all the Negroes and Powell, too, could hear him. General Ulysses S. Grant, my friend. Take your hat off to General Ulysses S. Grant. Come to Alabama at last. Colonel Powell reined his horse in long enough to lean down and say, while the Negroes took their hats off and cheered him, come to my rooms in the relay house for a toddy this evening, sir. There's a little fate, and I believe you'd be at home. All the rest of the hot day, as train after train pulled in and the Negroes piled off into the sweet-smelling barbecue smoke and swirling dust, and the band blared Dixie at the white moss-backed farmers down from the hills with their creaking wagons full of half-fed children and long rifles, Powell took his bow when one white man or another announced him as General U.S. Grant. And Pate thought, indeed, oh, indeed, I am at home in Birmingham. Thank you, Colonel. I am at home. Pate, nay Petrovich, was last of Furman Street in Syracuse, New York, owner of 6 barges on the Erie Canal and a chop house with bar on Water Street. He had once been Right Honorable Undersheriff of Onondaga County and was a grass widower with no children whose wife had run away with a Canadian bargeman. Before he came here, he sold his barges, his restaurant, his house, and his furniture for less than they were worth. That, he considered, had been a cheap price to pay for getting away from grim Syracuse. He had made it out 2 weeks after his 40th birthday. Colonel Powell, in his suite of rooms in the relay house, the thing they called a hotel, at ease on a green silk settle shaped like something that looked as if it might try to eat a man, had introduced him around. Gentlemen, Mr. Walsley Pate, Mr. Pate is late come among us, but I have reason to believe he has enterprise. And Pate had taken pains not to let himself puff up into the sin of pride, which would not do among these men. Mr. Pate, the Ellington Land Company, and friends. He had nodded and taken the hands that came toward him and filed the dozen or so names. Most of the names he'd heard shuttled about on the porch of the relay house in the week he had been there. The flesh to the names had whiskers and broadcloth swallowtail coats like himself, and some smelled like wood smoke, some like rose water, some like whiskey, all like money. They had red iron ore dust on their boots and seemed to take great pleasure in referring to one another as colonel or judge. Pate smoothed his beard often to make himself feel at ease, took a cigar when it was offered him, and felt swarthy and foreign among the accents. "You are not from this region, Mr. Pate," one or another would ask nearly every time he opened his mouth to start a conversation. "No, sir, I'm from Syracuse in the state of New York."
"I see. Were you engaged in the late unpleasantness?"
"I was not, sir. My business was such that I considered it more important to hire a replacement and remain with it."
"A blessing for our side, no doubt, sir. You're in Birmingham on business, then?"
"I am, yes, sir," Pate would answer and think. "Why else would a human being be here?"
"Purchasing land?"
"No, sir, I intend to settle. I'm a capitalist, not a speculator." Powell himself held court and said little to him. After the supper dishes had been cleared, he was joined on the couch by a little pinch-faced man with a wisp of whiskers under his chin who seemed to blink at people more than he spoke to them. The man had come late and hadn't given his name. Now and again, for the rest of the evening, Pate noticed the two of them watching him, listening to him. Sometimes the man made a remark to Powell, while his eyes stayed on Pate, the way, Pate thought, somebody like him might once have sized up a Negro he was considering buying. Pate worked hard at pretending he didn't notice. After a time, the Ellington Land Company and friends got drunk enough to start calling each other by Christian names and celebrating the vote and deciding who was going to get what office in the county government and more or less let him be. Never know they had lost a war. Business as usual. But that, too, was all right. It was a time to be still and watch. He tried to leave before he got as drunk as they were, but every time he did, Colonel Powell called him back. That and the pinch-faced man's unnatural interest puzzled and unsettled him. He was an outsider, a foreigner, and such small potatoes these men couldn't even make a decent pot roast with him. He got stiller and watched harder. Now Powell's mantelpiece clock had gonged midnight long ago, and there were just three of them left, four if you counted Powell's Negro, which nobody seemed inclined to do. Powell, himself, and the little pinch-faced man. Powell had sent out for more whiskey. He still sat erect, and even without his red sash and horse made Pate think of a man posing for a statue. His thick white hair was smoothed back neat as a wig. His eyes were serious and steady, his mouth hard and straight, and he held a silver toddy cup in front of him like a pistol. These people talked so slowly that, except for a certain flattening in the pitch of the man's voice, you'd never have known he was so drunk he had needed help to walk straight enough to go into the hall and use the chamber pot not 10 minutes ago. Control it was. Energy and control. "Mr. Pate," he said when he had seen that Pate was seated and toddied too, "my suspicions are confirmed."
"Sir?"
Pate put his toddy down. By God, he knew he should have paid more mind to his unsettledness. He had not a friend within 1,000 miles if these men had decided to make something out of this late unpleasantness thing. Powell smiled a small smile that said he was pleased with himself.
"I have remarked your conversation this evening. You are indeed a man of enterprise.
Pate left his toddy where it was. I've tried to be so, Colonel.
I take it, too, from your actions on my behalf this afternoon that you are not a so-called friend of the Negro.
They've never been an especial concern of mine, no, sir.
I find it very interesting that you have experience in enforcement of the law in your native state, too, Mr. Pate.
Some, Colonel, though my primary interest is business, you understand.
Of course, sir. That's what remains for us today, isn't it? Might I ask if you've considered that there's no necessary contradiction between those two interests?
Damn, the man kept you fuzzled. No, sir, I have not. Powell swept his arm toward the little wispy-whiskered man who had sat quietly in an armchair and cradled his toddy cup in his lap since the last of the others had left.
Have you met my associate, Major Tucker, Mr. Pate?
Somebody wearing a watch chain had run Winston Knox off the front porch of the relay house at dark. Then, since the voting was over, so was the free whiskey, and Winston wasn't of a mind to do without until all his business was done. He found him a white saloon, Webb's, where they told him the whiskey was all right. He wouldn't have known. He wasn't a drinking man, but for the little he made up himself. While he was in Webb's, a wind like there was about to be a rain had blown up, and when he came out, he didn't know if it was the whiskey or the wind that made his hat keep slipping off. He didn't know either what time it was, except surely it was the middle of the night, and he kept being surprised that his fingers were holding his rifle all by themselves so that he forgot he was even carrying it for minutes at a time. In the relay house, the windows that Burl, the colonel's darky, had shown to him that morning were still lit. Burl had been afraid and told him he didn't want to lose his job for telling Winston where the man he worked for lived, but Winston had promised him he wouldn't let on where he'd found out. Him and Burl weren't in the habit of refusing one another things. All day he had kept telling himself that he'd just wait till the colonel got settled and could concentrate, and then he'd go up to those rooms and ask him. But he knew he was lying. That wasn't it at all. He walked the block to the railroad tracks and stared up at the lit window on the second floor of the relay house. Clouds scudded over the high-pitched roof of the wind, and when he watched them, he lost his balance. There was no other light in the building, nobody coming in or out. He thought he saw Burl's big, stooped shape move in front of the light. From down the street, somebody clattered out of Webb's, cussed, a mule brayed, and then a wagon jangled away towards the woods to the north. He stayed without moving till the wagon was gone, trying to make out more things inside the window. He'd never asked anybody for a job before. He didn't know just how you were supposed to go about that, but he did know it was time to. He hadn't hardly even seen a piece of real money since the war was over, and nobody else he knew had either. There was a right smart you could grow on 35 acres, but not plows, nor mules, nor clothes to wear if you didn't have a woman to make them for you, nor would you get a woman without a shirt on your back. I dug coal, he'd say to the colonel. Dug it since I was 9. I can dig coal 13, 14 ton a day, you give me the blasting powder. I can get it out of the pickaxe, you ain't got no blasting powder. He was on the porch of the hotel now and didn't recollect he had walked over to it. There was an open door leading up some stairs in front of him. If he was more used to walking in shoes, he wouldn't be making so damn much noise. Burl wore shoes every day now. Get me 2 pair of shoes, he thought. Get me 2 pair of shoes, get me a decent suit of clothes, get me $40 in my pocket, then get me out. It was all right. Burl, being a darky, got his shoes the way he did. Get me another drink of whiskey, I had another nickel, he thought. He ought to go home. But if he did, he'd never work up to coming and asking for a job again. Lights lit, Burl's moving around. The man ain't asleep. He can give you a job as easy in the middle of the night as in the middle of the day, can't he? He stood with his foot on the first step of the dark stairs until he was sure he had his balance, then started up. Pate calculated, then lost his figures in the fuddle of the toddies in the hour. At $5 per week per convict, split among himself and the judge and whoever else was involved in court costs down here. Well, take a low figure and say his share was 50 cents. Not a fortune, but that was per week, per convict, and how many weeks would it take one of them to work off his court costs? Now, Major, what might we expect court costs to run on, oh, a $5 vagrancy fine? He asked the little man, who sat on the edge of his chair as if he were waiting to be asked to declaim. Pate couldn't like him. There was something of the staring fanatic in his eyes, a thing he had noticed in more than a few of these Southern redeemers. It might be, he considered, a source of their energy. Well, that depends on the judge, of course, Mr. Pate. I'd say that given a cooperative judge, which we will attempt to furnish you, roughly $200. I beg your pardon. Powell, his pistol of a toddy glass aimed at Pate, said, "It's a fair figure, Mr. Pate. 50 cents a week per prisoner for up to 40 weeks for a vagrancy charge? What in God's name might court cost be for a felon?" He tried to calculate again. Even if he was able to furnish them with only 10 prisoners a week, at the end of 40 weeks, he could have 400 leased out. And if he'd been able to furnish them 20 a week, "Very impressive, sir," he said, and thought, "Oh, by God, yes, you've figured out how to ride them." He reached for his beard to calm his hands, and if this place turned out and grew 30 a week, 40, you will need considerable labor, I take it, at a reasonable cost. Tucker inched a little more forward in his seat. "Mr. Pate, my associates and I control in one coal field, in one field, I repeat, three times the amount of coal as exists in the state of Pennsylvania. Two-thirds the amount in all of England, Mr. Pate. Nearly 8,000 square miles of coal field. Are you listening to me, Mr. Pate? Our coal field can supply the world, the entire world, with all the coal it needs for the next, listen to me, sir, the next 270 years. And there are others, perhaps even vaster, that we are only now exploring. I don't speak of the iron ore, the limestone, the fire clay, Mr. Pate." "Historic, Major. Historic. What in the hell else was a man supposed to say to that?" "Frankly, Mr. Pate, we need a city marshal who is not from among us. We are, as you are aware, occupied by Northern troops, yet..."
"A disgrace, Major." The Major blinked at him and shoved a hair closer to the edge of his chair. Powell's Negro silently crossed the room and poured him another toddy. The window curtains snapped out into the room on a gust of rain-smelling wind as Pate tried the figures again, adding zeros. Suddenly, like the snapping curtains, Tucker took the big Negro's wrist. "Look at that, Mr. Pate. That is what we have that you don't. Harness that, and you have enough strength to lift the entire white South into a new civilization." He let go of the wrist. The big Negro looked blank as a brick wall and went back to his chair in the corner. "And what is it doing now? It's wandering like the children of Israel, listening to promises made by scoundrels who don't understand the first thing about it." The Major finally made it off his chair, up and declaiming. Powell watched him with what Pate determined was controlled interest. Tucker paced to the window, slapped at a curtain, and turned to the room again. Pate was impressed. "Do you understand me, sir?"
"I understand, Major, that you need a supplier who can furnish you what you need at the least risk to yourself, someone who can deal with the federal authorities with the least friction or suspicion. Do I understand you?" Tucker sat and cradled his cup in his lap.
"Yes."
Powell aimed his own cup again. "You can, of course, furnish letters of introduction, Mr. Pate." "If I didn't," Pate thought, "between myself and $2, I could damn well have a half dozen made up by morning in this place." He picked up his cup now and raised it, working hard at looking discreet. "A toast, gentlemen." While he tried to think of a reasonable toast, a heavy knock rattled the door. Powell and Tucker glanced at each other, and the Negro got to his feet.
"It's a whiskey, Colonel," Tucker said.
Powell nodded and motioned his Negro to the door. The man who stood in it, a man just beyond a boy's age, blinked at the light. He snatched his hat off, glared at the Negro, and made as if he were going to step into the room. The Negro didn't move. The man looked past him.
"Colonel Powell,"
he said.
"You have business with me?"
Powell said, without getting up. He put his cup down and moved his hand slowly beneath his coat. The man, the boy, focused on him. Pate judged him to be a mossback from what he had come to know of mossbacks in a week. Hair larded, face hollow and grim, a single gallus holding up his trousers, a rifle growing out of his hand. No threat to these men. The kind of boy who died for them at Shiloh by the thousands, he'd warrant.
"Yes, sir," the boy said. I come about..."
The man's eyes had moved from Powell and settled on Tucker. His lips worked, but nothing came out, like Pate thought he was suddenly talking just to himself.
"State your business," Powell said to him. "Burl, get out of the way so I can see the man."
The Negro stepped slowly back, keeping himself between the man and Powell.
"I come,"
the boy said, and his face froze, stopped, wound down like a clock. His rifle was up before the Negro could more than grab the air beside it. Tucker's hand was only halfway to his face before the room filled up with noise and black powder smoke, and Tucker's head, its eyes in mid-blink, its wispy beard erased by the rifle ball, snapped back like a cracked whip. Pate gagged, but nonetheless leapt for the dark hole of the doorway. He and the Negro reached it at the same time, reached it just as the ball from Powell's Derringer slapped the door frame. But in the seconds it took them to get there, the boy had vanished, disappeared into the blackness as surely as a blown-out flame.
Space break.
First, he had remembered in pieces, the way it had come slipping up on him while he was out plowing the mule or sitting on the front porch of an evening before bed. Then, because he had remembered the pieces so much, he had got it by heart, like a story from the Bible. He could close his eyes and tell himself all of a single piece, like this. He recollected how the summer dusk had flashed with fireflies while he watched them hang his daddy upside down over the stack of dry branches and kindling. It had been sometime in August, in 1861. He had turned 10 that month, and he recollected, too, how his skin had stung where sweat had got into the grass cuts. By the way his daddy had flailed while they piled the branches up, Winston knew he wanted to fight him and cuss him, but his arms were tied with his own belt, and somebody had stuffed a tore-off piece of his own shirt tail in his mouth. His black beard and hair hung upside down, too, so that he looked to Winston like something hung up to dry. He didn't look like his daddy. Didn't look like anybody. One of the men kicked away the dry leaves from around the stack of branches beneath his daddy and said something about, did they want to burn the whole woods down for one damn mossback unionist? Winston recognized the man. He had been loading coal down on the river for old man Hanby with Winston's daddy that morning when his daddy had said that if he was going off in anybody's army, it'd be the other side's. He didn't have not a tooth in his head nor a shoe on his foot. A couple of the others he recognized, too. They were both big dogs whose people had creek bottom land and niggers over between Trustville and Elyton and had come riding by his house last month to talk to his daddy. When they left, his daddy was hollering at him that he wasn't studying killing nobody just so they could keep their slaves. Now, one of them, the baby-faced littlest one, had on a uniform Winston had never seen before, a gray one, lighter breeches and a darker coat with gold on the shoulders. He was telling everybody what to do and passing a jug around. They all fidgeted and paced to right smart like they were nervous, but nobody seemed to be in a hurry, no more than if they were watching a game of fives behind the courthouse. One of the other dozen or so men in the clearing hee-hawed at something. The second planter, who was raw-boned and red-headed and looked a couple of years older than the baby-faced one, maybe 22 or 23, told him to hush. Winston remembered that one's name was Matthews because the man had given him 3 cents once to hold his horse at a cockfight. The two men glared at each other for a minute, then Matthews said softer, "We're not having a party. It's necessary, that's all." Then he turned away with his face stiff and stared off into the woods just above where Winston was lying in the bushes. Winston ducked down and started to scrooch back some, but the darky who worked with his daddy at laying by time, Burl, held his big hand tight on his back to keep him still. His mama had sent both of them to look for his daddy when his daddy didn't come home for supper. Winston felt the rough Osnaburg cloth of Burl's sleeve making pock marks on his naked back, tried to wiggle out from under the hand, but Burl held tight. "I got to get to mama," Winston hissed at him. "Shh," Burl whispered back. "Ain't good dark yet, little Knox. They catch us. They fixin' to burn him up." "No, they ain't. They just scaring him. He a white man." The man who'd kicked the leaves away, the coal loader, poked his daddy with a stick to keep him from twisting. "It ain't no good, Knox," he said. "You had a fair chance. I'm sorry for you." The baby-faced man in the uniform stepped up to the pile of branches and pointed at them with his boot toe. "That's enough," he said. "You looking to fire a locomotive?" The man who had hee-hawed did it again. This time, Matthews kept staring at the woods. Winston's daddy twisted his shoulders hard to try to keep his eyes Winston couldn't tell anything about in the dusk, set on the baby-faced one. "Clayton," the baby-faced one said to Matthews, "what was that one's name?" Winston had to know his name. They were doing this to his daddy, and he had to remember the man's name. Was it Tucker? Yeah, Tucker. That was what his daddy called him last month, Tucker. When this was all over and they cut his daddy down, because nobody would really do this to his daddy would surely want to know he remembered the man's name. Tucker, it was Tucker. "Clayton, you want to do it?" Matthews shook his head, then with an effort turned back to face the others. "You can," he said. Tucker turned to the men. "All right, boys, who's for it?" The coal loader handed his long, sharps rifle to a man beside him. "It was me heard him say it, Captain." Tucker nodded. "Then wait till I tell you." The coal loader knelt and sparked his flint a couple of times into a little heap of punk he had made up. He blew on the punk, and when a wisp of smoke rose, he crisscrossed what Winston knew were pitch pine slivers over it. Winston's daddy saw that and started grunting, deep sounds over and over. Winston listened hard to make sure it was his daddy. His daddy had never made sounds like that before. They scared him. Everything in the clearing was getting harder and harder to see in the growing dusk. It was a magic lantern show the lamp was going out in. From behind him, Winston heard the steady sound of water flowing out of the spring, and around him the cicadas shrieking rose and fell, like it made them no mind at all about his daddy. The evening breeze gusted, scattered leaves, brought the light smell of smoke to him. The fireflies flashed brighter. Tucker unsheathed his sword and held it up like it was a torch. "God have mercy on you, Luther Knox. May your sorry life go to serve as an example from this day forth. If it does, you'll have fulfilled some purpose on this earth." He looked around him in the dying light, like he was waiting for somebody to clap, his little face balled up like a fist.
Theo, for God's sake, Matthews said. Tucker shot him a sharp look and lowered his sword. All right, he said to the coal loader. Now? The coal loader looked up at him, unsure. Hail, now! The coal loader shoved the burning pile of pine slivers underneath the branches. Winston felt Burl's hand move up his back and press his head down. He shook free. Let me be, he whispered fiercely. You lied to me. They're going to do it. Winston's daddy's grunts had lengthened, turned into muffled little screams, the kinds of noises a hog made when you drug it out to the slaughtering frame. One of the men, a barefoot one, broke from the others and ran to the fire. Hey, he whooped, look at him! He snatched up a sliver of burning pitch pine and raised it high with one hand while he leaned over the pile of branches and pulled his daddy to him. His daddy's body lashed like a snake's you'd trapped with a hoe, but the man held on. Then he jammed the sliver of burning pitch between the buttons of his daddy's pants and gave him a push to set him spinning. Both ends at once, T hollered. Give me another and I'll get his ears too. Matthew stepped to the man and shoved him out of the way. He pulled a branch from the pile and slapped the burning sliver away from Winston's daddy with it. God damn it, he yelled at the man. God damn it! He whirled and held the branch like a club, like he was keeping the dogs away from a kill. Everybody in the clearing got still, watching. All their fidgeting and pacing stopping like people on a music box that had run out. The fire caught, rose, spit sparks out among the fireflies, broke up the shrieking of the cicadas with its loud cracking. His daddy's noises changed again, pitched higher and higher, just squeals, pure hog squeals, not screams now. His hair caught, then his beard, then the rag in his mouth. Winston smelled it, the bitter smell of burning hair, and rolled from beneath Burl's heavy arm. Burl grabbed for him and missed. Winston took a step toward his daddy, but his daddy was already somebody else, was something Winston was afraid of. He turned one way, turned another. Then, his legs so weak that he stumbled into briars that bit at him like dog's teeth, into claws of tree limbs, choking on what was coming up from his stomach, nothing in focus, not looking back, he ran through the darkening woods toward the sound of the water. Then, tonight, with the coal oil smoke rising like wiggling black snakes from the lamps in Colonel Powell's room, Winston had thought, Daddy? Daddy, he come back. Daddy, he's right here, Daddy. He's sitting right there, Daddy. It's him, Daddy. And he didn't hardly feel the weight of the rifle in the least as it came up and followed his eyes to Tucker's face. But when his thumb pulled the hammer back, and then the trigger gave beneath his finger, and he felt the kick and heard the explosion that emptied the room of everything but itself, it had been all as solid and right as an axe, catching a log's grain and splitting it straight through to the ground. Now he ran along the wide, empty street until it stopped in the middle of a cornfield. He stumbled into the beat-down corn rows, trying to run still, trying to find a door into the dark wall of the woods at the edge of the field, running again just like in 61. Clay mud clung to his shoes and built up heavy as pig iron. He heard people hollering in the piece of a town behind him, heard a couple of pistols go off. God in heaven would forgive him what he'd done. But them people wouldn't. Thank you.